Our next presentation, using proximity object detection to increase shovel productivity in the open pit mine. Our next speaker is Eric Shea. He's product manager technology with Joy Global. He's going to explain how the use of additional sensors and an interactive control system, operators can monitor, anticipate, and predict dipper position. Please welcome Eric Shea.
All right, so third day of the conference. I'm the second to last person, the next to last person before you get to head on your merry way, so we'll try to make this worth your time. Who's still around? Mark, all right. So just by a show of hands, who's a miner? Who's like a FCX or, okay, a couple miners here, great, good. Who is with an OEM, like, you know, I'm from Joy Global, any Liebherr or Caterpillar folks here, any OEM folks? Okay, fantastic. Who's from a technology provider here? I'm guessing a lot of people here are technology providers. Good, yeah, I see you, Nima. Okay, who's from a non-technology vendor of some sort? Okay, a couple, stuck around, great. And anybody from academic institutions? Okay, right. Okay, good. So we have a pretty good mix here. The topic that me and my partner in crime, I'm Eric, I'm from Joy Global, I'm the product manager for surface technology. And Pat, I don't know if you want to do yourself a quick introduction.
I'm Pat DeWitt. I'm an operator trainer for Joy Global.
Stop. Go ahead. Please.
Good enough.
So I'm an office rat, and Pat is really the person who can give you who you actually trust when he says something works here. Because I can talk until my face is blue, but until you see someone out in the field who's actually seeing any of these things, it really doesn't matter. So what I wanted to talk about today is proximity detection and how it can increase productivity in a mine. And really, this is born from our experiences developing the latest autonomous technology. It's called TrackShield that we're introducing this year. And I'll be quite honest with you, our goal wasn't to increase productivity, but I'd rather be lucky than good any day of the week, right? So when I say proximity detection avoidance, what do you think about? What do you guys think about when I say proximity? Yeah. Hidden other things. So safety, right? Safety is the first thing. Increase the safety. What's another thing you think about when I say proximity detection? Awareness, okay. What about reducing maintenance costs, right? So hitting the trucks, not only is it a safety event, it's also a headache for your maintainers. Any maintainers here, by the way? So you know what we're talking about. If two large objects hauling stuff hit each other, that's maintenance cost. But increased digging production? I'll tell you why. So basically, you know, I like to simplify things as much as possible. So collision avoidance really comes down to perceiving the world around you and then avoiding, right? So if I can't see, I need some other way of perceiving my world around me before I hit the table. So really just two steps. If I want to make it a little bit more, involved, you have a bunch of sensors, and you've heard a lot of different technology experts talk about the sensors, for example, the JPS that Dave just talked about, that goes into some sort of a decision engine. Then that translates into machine action. In our case, Joy Global makes shovels. So the shovel changes track, and then that in turn goes back to the decision engine. Pretty basic, right? System engineering 101. Well, that software decision engine currently really is the what? Is a human, right? In the Air Force, we used to call this the Brain Mark One. So that's really what it comes down to. You perceive and you avoid the object. And right now, with the machine, the operator is the software decision engine. In terms of collision detection, we usually think of it as, say, shovel to truck, two separate objects. But in terms of actual electric mining shovels, you can really think of the dipper and the track as two separate objects they're trying to avoid between collisions. Anybody operate a shovel here? You're a shovel operator, sir? But you did stay at a Holiday Inn last night, right? Well, Pat can attest to, you know, the kind of collisions that happen between the dippers and the tracks. So really, the object proximity detection problems that I'm talking about right now is between the dipper and the tracks. Still two objects, one object in 3D space and the other essentially in 2D space, but working, interacting with the second one in that 3D space. So the dipper, as it's swinging, as the shovel is operating, is about to hit the tracks. That's what happens if you don't stop it. And then using the track shield system, it integrates the perception and avoidance systems. It estimates a pose using the Centurion control data that's on our shovels. And then it also mitigates that detected collision using the Centurion control system. So, you know, because everything is on board our shovels, we're able to use Centurion for both perception and for mitigation. So that's a advantage we have right now. And as a result, the shovel is, the dipper is moved out of the way of the tracks. Pat, do you have anything anything?
Just with respect to this, you know, the initial concept was, as Eric said, to avoid the striking of the tracks. From a safety standpoint, you know, not only, if the safety standpoint of it is it also avoids the jostling of the operator. You know, with these ultra-class shovels, the booms and the dippers are pretty heavy. And so, consequently, if you do have a strike, probably 70% of the time creates a boom jack. And if you don't catch it and the boom drops, that's quite a shock to the operator's back. And then from a maintenance standpoint, it just, for obviously, you're just saving on your tracks. And as these shovels get bigger, with the bigger dippers and the bigger shovels, it's becoming a more and more frequent occurrence.
Right. So what I want to introduce, again, I'm a simple guy, so I'm going to try to simplify things so that I could understand it better. And hopefully it's a model that is understandable to most people as well. You can almost think of anything within the mine as a system optimization problem, right? Or perhaps a mathematical optimization problem. So most of you are probably familiar with the Goldratt theory of constraints. And really, even at the shovel level, there's certain constraints as far as in 3 space, in terms of the operator's perception, in terms of different factors, how far away you're from the face, how far away you're from the truck, that really create this natural constraint problem. And so essentially, if I want to really take the kind of the operator mojo out of the picture, it becomes a simple optimization problem. So any of you who've done automation can also attest that you try to narrow things down to a set of constraints, to a set of variables where you can optimize, do path optimization. Now, yesterday we talked about, I think Siemens talked about the Balaz 500-ton truck. And this is a perfect example, the perfect illustration of what I'm trying to say here. Everybody's trying to supersize things. How do you get more out of your mine? Well, you make everything bigger. So every single dig that comes through, you get more material out of the earth, right? Is the Komatsu guy still here? Okay, so the approach that most OEMs and other vendors have been taking is the supersizing. But then what I call the law of unintended consequences really kicks in. So it turns out just because you make the dipper bigger, you make the truck bigger, well, guess what? There's no shovels that load those trucks yet in 3 passes, right? So you need to go 4 pass, 3.5 pass, whatever it is. And then you make the shovels bigger, then you got to have bigger dippers. And then your motors don't actually work that way. And then your structures actually, it turns out, it fatigues faster. And then you have to maintain it faster. So it's not a simple linear vector problem. And this is a key point here, is the fill factor. As it turns out, when you make everything bigger, operators don't work as well. And Pat, do you want to speak to your observations in Australia?
Yeah, this actually was very shocking to me. I spent the last 2.5 years off and on in Australia, and where we have a couple of test machines. And the original concept of TrackShield was a safety maintenance cost savings due to the Boss machines and the oil sands and so forth with the ultra-wide tracks and the ultra-big car bodies for obvious reasons. Over in Australia, all the in the coal mines over there, they all have 82-yard dippers on the 4100 XBC DC and AC machines. And I was in the Bowen Basin on one of them that had track shield. And the revelation I had, because one of the biggest things that I'm having a problem with as a trainer is that as we get ultra-sized, the operators are slowing down their cycle times because they don't want to get in trouble with their maintenance supervisors and their operating supervisors for destroying the shovels, jacking the boom, wrecking the tracks, busting off the Dutchman on the buckets and so forth. So consequently, they're slowing down their cycle times, backing away from the dig face, so now you have these 82-yard dippers, but you're only getting 3/4 of a pass per cycle, and so all of a sudden, very quickly, you're losing production. And the one thing that struck me almost instantaneously with TrackShield is that, I had to actually jump in the seat and operate for an hour just to verify that it really was working this well. What happened is when you're coming down, we're digging in basalt with the waste material at this particular mine. And what really struck me is that when you dig close to the dig face as you should to maximize your fill factor, track shield actually at its point of contact with using the track avoidance where your GED teeth make the contact on the dig face is a good training point. It's the operator that's the perfect point of engagement. We were getting 100 to 105 to 110% fill factor every pass. That just blew me away. Pardon me. And the guy that I was with was a relatively new operator. And so once I showed this to him and he had a little bit of confidence in it, almost instantaneously he picked up a good 8 to 10 seconds in his cycle time, and every pass was a full pass. So we were three pass in 300-ton class trucks.
Yeah. So confidence is a big deal here. I mean, that's...
Absolutely.
That's a point that Pat saw. You can't see as well as an operator when you have these big dippers around. And so if you're going down to the tracks blind, you need some way of increasing that confidence.
Actually, one to that point, the operators, because of these ultra-class buckets, you know, with the new Centurion cabs that we have, and it's actually kind of comical watching them, they move the seats all the way forward, jack them up and tilt them forward. They almost look like they're going to fall right out of the seat just because of this, so they can see the tracks. They're actually running like this, and they're all complaining that their backs hurt. And so when I showed them this, they set the seat up as designed to use the ergonomic benefits of the seat, and the guys were just, they just couldn't comment enough about how just that much easier it made their job.
So safety there comes up again.
Safety, exactly. Safety and ergonomics.
Seat there. So really, when I look at Pat, I see an experienced shovel operator. But really what he is a keeper of that optimum solution. I used to work with fighter pilots, and none of them will tell you that a machine will ever take over their job. And on some level, they're right. There have been autonomous developments in the U.S. Air Force for decades. And the reality is, who's still driving the airplanes? Still the pilots. But a lot more electronically assisted nowadays. F-16, the first fly-by-wire jet, now the F-22. And really, if by the end of this presentation, you only walk away with one thing, it's that we need to help the operators be better through training and through tools that help them use the best practices. And really, the way that I look at shovel operator trainers is that they're the keepers of those best practices derived through human experience. Now, there's a lot of smart people in this room, a lot of folks who have developed autonomous systems. You can develop autonomous solutions and get at those solutions through mathematical methods as well. That's just as legitimate. But right now, I know I have Pat here. I know that he's got the experience. I know that he's done one-on-one shovel shoot-offs. We were talking about this last night. where they would have competitions between someone who thought he was hot stuff as a shovel operator. Pat's slow and steady, but knows what he's doing, how to get the best, most effective loads into the trucks. Guess what? Pat beat that hotshot operator because he is the keeper of the optimized solution. Pat, you want to talk to this picture?
What this is the biggest part of your cycle is your swing. And where this is relevant to track shield is that when you want to maximize your fill factor, because you want to minimize your passes to the truck, you know, especially now as the trucks get bigger and bigger and bigger. Two jobs from now, actually not too far from here, we're working on loading 400-ton class trucks with 2,800 size shovels. And so that's where this with track shield becomes very, very important. Because the more weight you're getting in the dipper and you're working right at the upper engineered limits of the shovel, you want to make sure, you know, safety's key to everything that we do. And so we use this diagram in our classroom training to show the guys, you know, that when you're maximizing your fill factors, this maintains a nice smooth flow to the trucks. And so you're maximizing all the little things that go hand in hand with this.
Yeah, and once again, the experienced shovel operator will know where that point is between the green and the yellow, when to start decelerating so that he or she is pinpointed right above the truck bed where you're supposed to dump, right? And again, you can arrive at these through autonomous solutions, and we will. I'm a technologist, so I believe that technology will take over that role eventually, but not right now.
Keep this picture in mind. We have another slide further on that goes hand in hand with this, and I'll explain how the correlation between this and the other one.
So in terms of enforcing shovel best practices, the track shield system allows for an operator to go full speed within a prescribed envelope. So basically, it sets boundaries. I have a one-year-old daughter, and it's our first. Who's got kids who are babies or toddlers or whatever? So it's my first. So those of you who are parents are probably going to laugh at me for saying this because it's old hat to you. But I mean, one of the things is I got to teach her the boundaries. So in a sense, what track shield does is it enforces certain boundaries that is outside of recommended practices. If they want to go there, if a mine lets them go there, that's your prerogative. We're all adults here. But it's going to severely reduce the productivity of your mine. And it really is an extension of the boom limits concept. So those of you who are familiar with P&H Centurion shovels, know that we have a boom limit system where it lets the operator set where the maximum crowd extension and the maximum crowd retraction is going to be at. So in a sense, that's already a little bit of a collision avoidance, right? Because it's trying to avoid having the greenhorns hit against the stick. Pat, did you want to talk to either of these points?
No, you hit that one pretty good.
Okay. So really, this enforcement, if you want to call it that, is really about muscle memory, visual memory. The more you do something, repetition makes perfection. Or perfect repetition makes perfection. So the more you can do the same actions over and over again, the more your mind will memorize it. So that's a view that we have of the shovel operator. So once you get used to the limits kicking in at a certain point where you know, oh, okay, my dipper's not going to hit the tracks, you might not even really need track shield anymore. After track shield is turned off, Then you will have memorized where it is.
Pat? I'll correct you. Yes, you do. The other benefit to track shield is we used to teach years ago. I've been a trainer since 1981. I've been an operator since 1978. And we used to teach, you know, because you want to get them trucks out of there as fast as you can. As I told the shovel operators, our job is to keep the truck drivers pissed off. So what we used to teach is, though, and especially with the bigger shovels, when you're coming down off the truck, your point of engagement is always at the toe of the face. But one of the things that started occurring in my observations is that, especially as the trucks are getting bigger, by your second or third round, without moving forward, is when you come down to your point of engagement and you start penetrating the bank, you start healing the bucket, which minimizes your fill factor, and it also increases the your wear and tear on the heel band and the Dutchman of your bucket. Trivial point. You should never, ever have excess wear on your heel band or your Dutchman on your shovels. If you have that, you need operator training because your shovels are mispositioned. Those parts of the dipper should never, ever touch dirt. With respect to this, too, so one of the new ways of teaching that we're doing is we're telling the guys, you always come back to the full tuck, because what that does is it minimizes and almost totally avoids your heel band touching the face. You know, when you get, when you start to get to that position, you move, okay? The other benefit of track shield, when you're coming back to the full tuck and you build the confidence, as we said earlier, and it keeps, with respect to the muscle memory and visual memory, it keeps painting a very consistent picture as to where your dipper should be every pass to maximize your fill factor and to minimize the excess wear on unnecessary parts of the dipper.
Yep.
And there again, another additional maintenance savings.
The next couple of slides are going to show two scenarios, and I'll run through them real quick. The first scenario is the hoist lowering to a tuck position, to the optimum position, and how track shield helps enforce that best practice. So this shows that the operator is lowering the dipper, and since track shield doesn't detect any type of the collision impending, it doesn't do anything. As the dipper keeps lowering, track shield in its time horizon sees that, oh, if this trajectory continues, there will be a collision, but doesn't do anything because it's far enough to where the operator still has time to intervene. However, by the time that the dipper gets so close, track shield recognizes that those commands will cause a collision, so it applies an overriding command and begins to reduce the lower reference. Now, you're really close here, and track shield says, whoa, buddy, if you don't stop now, you will hit the tracks. And at this point, track shield reduces the reference to up to zero if it detects that collision is going to happen without its intervening. Now, after this has been done, the operator reference is fully returned to him or her because at this time, track shield no longer overrides the hoist reference. And again, with the autonomous assist tool like a track shield active, the operator with this kind of repetitive machine motion can get that muscle memory because we all really, I mean, we drive, we operate things on feel as well as the visual memory. The second best practice is in terms of crowding down to the optimum position. So you've just returned to tuck and you're gonna get ready to engage the bank and how it intervenes in this case. So in this scenario, there's no reference. The operator hasn't done anything yet. He's already pretty darn close, but since there's no reference, track shield doesn't do anything. As the operator is crowding downward to engage the bank, track shield detects that, there could be a collision, but again, doesn't do anything because of the slow speed. It's extremely close to the tracks, but it's slow enough to where the operator's reference continues. Now, as the operator keeps going down, track shield recognizes that you're so close that if no intervention is done, you will hit the tracks. So at this point, track shield reduces the applied lower reference, the extension reference. And as the operator recognizes that now is the time to go ahead and hoist up and engage the bank, the track shield system no longer overrides the crowd reference. And so you can see how with autonomous operator assist, you can really start to get the operator trained into getting to the optimum digging position.
Hold that slide right there. The different descriptions that I just given to you, almost 100% of the time, this is where you're going to come down with it. And so you're maximizing your teeth engagement to the dig face, and you're maximizing every pass. As I said, when I was on that machine in Australia, and I mean, I was running as fast as I could run it. As Eric said earlier, I'm typically a slow, steady trying to maximize my fill factor, I worry more about that than cycle times, because if you can two and three pass a truck rather than 3 to 5 pass a truck because you're fast, I would rather go a little bit slower and maximize my fill factor. And that right there is the thing that blew me away the most, how consistently you can do that.
Yeah, and let me hold that thought. Again, I am all for technology progress. I am all for supersizing things if it makes your mining operations more productive. But it's a system, right? I mean, most of us are familiar with system engineering here, and it's not just a matter of simply increasing the physical size of your mining equipment. So, you know, so far I've talked about everything is on board the P&A shovel, the dipper, and the track. So that honestly made that engineering problem, you know, a lot simpler. You know, even with that, quite frankly, a very simple engineering problem, we still took some time to get this right, okay? And it was probably a little bit of a surprise to us, but we finally do have, with operator input, like from Pat, like with our experiences in Bean Canyon in Australia, we finally do have it, we believe, right. But what happens when you have multiple pieces of equipment to interact with each other? So now you've got multiple diverse pieces of shovels, your hexes and your EMSs, as well as different kinds of trucks. We've heard a couple of different solutions. I know Naptec talked about their LiDAR scanning solution. We have JPS. So there's different sensors that come into the picture, and we as an OEM, you know, we encourage that development, but obviously we don't have allegiance to anybody. But then it starts getting really complicated, is my point. It requires integration of multiple pieces of equipment, and so now you're no longer out of the simple Centurion operating. You gotta look at what type of truck it is. You gotta look at how big the truck bed is, and you know, is the truck bed made by a third-party vendor? Has anybody told anyone about it? So all these sort of complications come into the pictures. There's a couple of different options you could have. So the approach that a lot of people, and quite frankly the academic institutions prefer, is a reconstruction of the real world. So any video gamers here? Anybody willing to? Yeah, all right, Dan. I mean, that's what video games do, right? They reconstruct a real world in a virtual world. And so that's probably the most academic and probably the most complex approach you can go with. There's also the idea of peer-to-peer communication, where it's the machines talking to each other. And the machines basically say, I'm a truck, I'm coming to you, Mr. Shovel, and I'm this far away from you at this azimuth, at this angle. That works too, but it requires some communication protocols, it requires some agreements. If I am, say, if I'm a Joy Global P&A shovel and this is a cat truck, for example, well, do we agree to figure out what language we're going to use? Are we going to use, Wi-Fi? Are we going to use Chinese? Are we going to use English? So peer-to-peer communication. And then the simplest option is really to be equipment-centered. And really, I kind of like what I saw from NetTech, because in a sense, it's a, you know, look, I'm a piece of equipment. I'm going to detect my world around me, and that's it, right? You know, that's what I care about. That can be integrated with the two earlier options, but I guess as I see the world, again, I like to simplify things. Sometimes oversimplify, perhaps. This is the way I see it, you have those options. But ultimately, all of them, complexity increases dramatically when you're talking about multiple pieces of equipment, just rather than just, you know, talking about the dipper and the track on the shovel. Pat, any comments here?
No, you're good. Okay.
So basically, in conclusion, proximity detection and collision avoidance can be production enhancers. So again, when I asked you what you thought of when I said proximity detection, most of you probably didn't immediately think of production enhancement. Most of you probably thought of safety. Some of you who are perhaps in the county department maybe thought more about cost reduction. But it really, as hopefully we've demonstrated to you, can be a true production enhancer through training and through enforcement of best practices. Pat, did you want to talk to this...
Yes.
This picture?
I was going to let you finish, and then I was going to talk to it. Or I can now, whatever.
Go ahead and talk about it, and then I'll...
This is the other screen that I told you about with respect to the one previously. The one thing I noticed, as I mentioned earlier, when we started going to our big Optima buckets, is that all of a sudden the guys, as I said earlier, the guys moved back further away from the mining face to avoid track collisions, and they also slowed down their cycle time to avoid track collisions. So that was one of the benefits to Track Shield that I saw. So with respect to the trust issue, we could get the cycle times back as well. This is the other thing. The technical term for this is called successive pass loading. And this is the other thing we teach, and how this is relevant to the previous screen is that we try to maximize two-side loading, and we've actually developed mining sequencing now. So irregardless of where you are on the mining face, if you're cleaning up the pit edge or a high wall scenario, you can still safely maximize your two-side loading capabilities. So when you're two-side loading, the biggest thing I push is you maintain your tails for your cleanup, so the cleanup machines don't slow you down. But if your tails are maintained, you take bucket number one from right in the center to the right-hand truck. Bucket number two comes from that position there, and bucket number three, if you're on the bigger class trucks, comes from right there. And how this is relevant to Track Shield and the previous screen is that you're still maximizing your time off the corners of your car body, okay, in your tracks. But what this does is this significantly cuts off your swing time, which is swing is the biggest part of your cycle. So if we can maximize your coming down or retraction, you know, by gaining trust through Track Shield, so they're coming down full speed, and then obviously your hoisting speed is relevant to the fragmentation and the height of your dig face, and then increase your cycle time or decrease your cycle time, however you want to look at it, by using this. So by using Track Shield, because of the proximity, your amount of digs to the tracks, minimizing your swing by utilizing these technologies and these best practices, we've been able to significantly increase our production out of our bigger shovels. We're moving. One of the things that struck me at a couple of the mines I've been at in Australia and in Canada is we're moving more dirt in a 12-hour shift than when I started mining in 1973. We're moving more dirt in a shift than we used to move in a week.
So in closing, those of you who took a nap can go ahead and wake up now. Perception psychologists tell me that audiences never remember but 5% of your message. So again, if this is the only thing you remember, is that last point. If you stayed this long, you believe in technology. I believe in technology. That's why I'm here. So let's keep working on those sensors and those methods and those systems that lead us to full autonomy. Joy Global has a vision for a fully autonomous shovel as well. But where we are now is the ROI to the miner to invest in fully autonomous technologies for the sheer act of getting an ROI today. It's probably not going to be worth as much money as spending some time in autonomous assist systems such as Track Shield that help the operator become the best that they can be. And we'll go ahead and take some questions now. Any questions, comments?
Hey, Eric, what's holding up full autonomous operations on a shovel?
The question is, what's holding up fully autonomous shovels? R&D, commitment from the customer. We all know that there's a lot of different autonomous projects going on, and the mines really have chosen to fully automate the trucks first, and that makes sense because the degrees of freedom on a truck is far less than a shovel. Quite frankly, it's part of his budget. You know, my company gave our engineering team a lot more money to fully automate a shovel. I have no doubt we can get there pretty fast. But on top of that funding, it's also an issue of getting a customer committed, getting the mine committed to saying, hey, we're willing to go through some failures with you to figure out how to fully automate a shovel. So off the cuff, that's why I believe it's holding us back, Mark. Other questions for Pat, perhaps? Any operator folks? No?
Okay.
Well,
thanks, Eric.
Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Pat.